who was still a boy, connected two wires that electrocuted a pack of kids who were hunting him. The convulsing bodies, the grotesque expressions. Beatty, in the moments that led up to his victory in those long-ago Hunger Games, watched the others die. Not his fault, only self-defense. We were all acting only in self-defense. Suddenly, I want to leave the hummingbird room before somebody starts setting up a snare. Beatty, Plutarch said you had something for me.
Right, I do. Your new bow.
He presses a hand control on the arm of the chair and wheels out of the room. As we follow him through the twists and turns of special defense, he explains about the chair.
I can walk a little now. It's just that I tire so quickly, it's easier for me to get around this way.
How's Finnick doing?
He's having concentration problems, I answer. I don't want to say he had a complete mental meltdown.
Concentration problems, eh? Beatty smiles grimly. If you knew what Finnick's been through the last few years, you'd know how remarkable it is he's still with us at all.
Tell him I've been working on a new trident for him, though, will you? Something to distract him a little.
Distraction seems to be the last thing Finnick needs, but I promise to pass on the message. Four soldiers guard the entrance to the hall marked Special Weaponry. Checking the schedules printed on our forearms is just a preliminary step. We also have fingerprint, retinal, and DNA scans, and have to step through special metal detectors. Beatty has to leave his wheelchair outside, although they provide him with another one once we're through security. I find the whole thing bizarre, because I can't imagine anyone raised in District 13 being a threat the government would have to guard against. Have these precautions been put in place because of the recent influx of immigrants? At the door of the armory, we encounter a second round of identification checks, as if my DNA might have changed in the time it took to walk 20 yards down the hallway, and are finally allowed to enter the weapons collection. I have to admit, the arsenal takes my breath away. Row upon row of firearms, launchers, explosives, armored vehicles. Of course, the airborne division is housed separately, Beatty tells us.
Of course, I say, as if this would be self-evident.
I don't know where a simple bow and arrow could possibly find a place in all this high-tech equipment, but then we come upon a wall of deadly archery weapons. I've played with a lot of the Capitol's weapons in training, but none designed for military combat. I focus my attention on a lethal-looking bow so loaded down with scopes and gadgetry, I'm certain I can't even lift it, let alone shoot it.
Gail, maybe you'd like to try out a few of these, says Beatty.
Seriously? Gail asks.
You'll be issued a gun eventually for battle, of course, but if you appear as part of Katniss's team in the propos, one of these would look a little showier. I thought you might like to find one that suits you, says Beatty.
Yeah, I would.
Gale's hands close around the very bow that caught my attention a moment ago, and he hefts it onto his shoulder. He points it around the room, peering through the scope.
That doesn't seem very fair to the deer, I say.
Wouldn't be using it on deer, would I? He answers.
I'll be right back, says Beatty.
He presses a code into a panel, and a small doorway opens. I watch until he's disappeared and the door's shut.
So, it'd be easy for you, using that on people? I ask.
I didn't say that.
Gale drops the bow to his side.
But if I'd had a weapon that could have stopped what I saw happen in 12, if I'd had a weapon that could have kept you out of the arena, I'd have used it.
Me too, I admit. But I don't know what to tell him about the aftermath of killing a person, about how they never leave you.
Beatty wheels back in with a tall black rectangular case awkwardly positioned between his footrest and his shoulder. He comes to a halt and tilts it toward me.
For you.
I set the case flat on the floor and undo the latches along one side. The top opens on silent hinges. Inside the case, on a bed of crushed maroon velvet, lies a stunning black bow.
Oh!
I whisper in admiration. I lift it carefully into the air to admire the exquisite balance, the elegant design, and the curve of the limbs that somehow suggests the wings of a bird extended in flight. There's something else. I have to hold very still to make sure I'm not imagining it. No. The bow is alive in my hands. I press it against my cheek and feel the slight hum travel through the bones of my face. What's it doing? I ask.
Saying hello, explains Beatty with a grin. It heard your voice.
It recognizes my voice? I ask.
Only your voice, he tells me. You see, they wanted me to design a bow based purely on looks, as part of your costume, you know. But I kept thinking, what a waste. I mean, what if you do need it sometime, as more than a fashion accessory? So I left the outside simple and left the inside to my imagination. Best explained in practice, though. Want to try those out?
We do. A target range has already been prepared for us. The arrows that Beatty designed are no less remarkable than the bow. Between the two, I can shoot with accuracy over 100 yards. The variety of arrows, razor sharp, incendiary, explosive, turn the bow into a multi-purpose weapon. Each one is recognizable by a distinctive colored shaft. I have the option of voice override at any time, but have no idea why I would use it. To deactivate the bow's special properties, I need only tell it, good night. Then it goes to sleep until the sound of my voice wakes it again. I'm in good spirits by the time I get back to the prep team, leaving Beatty and Gale behind. I sit patiently through the rest of the paint job and don my costume, which now includes a bloody bandage over the scar on my arm to indicate I've been in recent combat. Venia affixes my Mockingjay pin over my heart. I take up my bow and the sheath of normal arrows that Beatty made, knowing they would never let me walk around with the loaded ones. Then we're out on the soundstage, where I seem to stand for hours while they adjust makeup and lighting and smoke levels. Eventually, the commands coming via intercom from the invisible people in the mysterious glassed-in booth become fewer and fewer. Fulvia and Plutarch spend more time studying and less time adjusting me. Finally, there's quiet on the set. For a full 5 minutes, I am simply considered. Then Plutarch says,
I think that does it.
I'm beckoned over to a monitor. They play back the last few minutes of taping, and I watch the woman on the screen. Her body seems larger in stature, more imposing than mine. Her face smudged but sexy. Her brows black and drawn in an angle of defiance, wisps of smoke suggesting she has either just been extinguished or is about to burst into flames, rise from her clothes. I do not know who this person is. Finnick, who's been wandering around the set for a few hours, comes up behind me and says with a hint of his old humor,
They'll either want to kill you, kiss you, or be you.
Everyone's so excited, so pleased with their work. It's nearly time to break for dinner, but they insist we continue. Tomorrow we'll focus on speeches and interviews and have me pretend to be in rebel battles. Today they want just one slogan, just one line that they can work into a short propo to show to coin. People of Panem, we fight, we dare, we end our hunger for justice. That's the line. I can tell by the way they present it that they've spent months, maybe years, working it out and are really proud of it. It seems like a mouthful to me, though, and stiff. I can't actually imagine saying it in real life, unless I was using a capital accent and making fun of it. Like when Gale and I used to imitate Effie Trinkets
May the odds be ever in your favor.
But Fulvia's right in my face, describing a battle I've just been in, and how my comrades in arms are all lying dead around me, and how, to rally the living, I must turn to the camera and shout out the line. I'm hustled back to my place, and the smoke machine kicks in. Someone calls for quiet. The cameras start rolling, and I hear action. So I hold my bow over my head and yell with all the anger I can muster. People of Panem, we fight, we dare, we end our hunger for justice. There's dead silence on the set. It goes on and on. Finally, the intercom crackles, and Haymitch's acerbic laugh fills the studio. He contains himself just long enough to say, "And that, my friends, is how a revolution dies."
Mockingjay, Disc 3, Chapter 6. The shock of hearing Haymitch's voice yesterday, of learning that he was not only functional but had some measure of control over my life again, enraged me. I left the studio directly and refused to acknowledge his comments from the booth today. Even so, I knew immediately he was right about my performance. It took the whole of this morning for him to convince the others of my limitations, that I can't pull it off. I can't stand in a television studio wearing a costume and makeup in a cloud of fake smoke and rally the districts to victory. It's amazing, really, how long I have survived the cameras. The credit for that, of course, goes to PETA. Alone, I can't be the Mockingjay. We gather around the huge table in command, Coin and her people, Plutarch, Fulvia, and my prep team, a group from 12 that includes Haymitch and Gale, but also a few others I can't explain, like Levy and Greasy Say. At the last minute, Finnick wheels Beatty in, accompanied by Dalton, the cattle expert from 10. I suppose that Coin has assembled this strange assortment of people as witnesses to my failure. However, it's Haymitch who welcomes everyone, and by his words, I understand that they have come at his personal invitation. This is the first time we've been in a room together since I clawed him. I avoid looking at him directly, but I catch a glimpse of his reflection in one of the shiny control consoles along the wall. He looks slightly yellow and has lost a lot of weight, giving him a shrunken appearance. For a second, I'm afraid he's dying. I have to remind myself that I don't care. The first thing Haymitch does is to show the footage we've just shot. I seem to have reached some new low under Plutarch and Fulvia's guidance. Both my voice and body have a jerky, disjointed quality, like a puppet being manipulated by unseen forces.
"All right," Haymitch says when it's over. "Would anyone like to argue that this is of use to us in winning the war?"
No one does.
"That saves time. So let's all be quiet for a minute. I want everyone to think of one incident where Katniss Everdeen genuinely moved you. Not where you were jealous of her hairstyle, or her dress went up in flames, or she made a halfway decent shot with an arrow. Not where PETA was making you like her. I want to hear one moment where she made you feel something real."
Quiet stretches out, and I'm beginning to think it will never end. When Levy speaks up,
"When she volunteered to take Prim's place at the reaping, because I'm sure she thought she was going to die."
"Good. Excellent example," says Haymitch.
He takes a purple marker and writes on a notepad.
"Volunteered for sister at reaping."
Haymitch looks around the table.
"Somebody else?"
I'm surprised that the next speaker is Boggs, who I think of as a muscular robot that does Coin's bidding.
"When she sang the song, while the little girl died."
Somewhere in my head, an image surfaces of Boggs with a young boy perched up on his hip.
In the dining hall, I think. Maybe he's not a robot after all.
Who didn't get choked up at that, right?
Says Haymitch, writing it down.
I cried when she drugged Peter so she could go get him medicine, and when she kissed him goodbye,
blurts out Octavia. Then she covers her mouth, like she's sure this was a bad mistake. But Haymitch only nods.
Oh, yeah. Drugs Peter to save his life. Very nice.
The moments begin to come thick and fast, and in no particular order, when I took Ruan as an ally, extended my hand to Chaff on interview night, tried to carry Mags, and again when I held out those berries that meant different things to different people. Love for Peter, refusal to give in under impossible odds, defiance of the capital's inhumanity. Haymitch holds up the notepad.
So, the question is, what do all of these have in common?
They were Katniss's, says Gale quietly. No one told her what to do or say.
Unscripted, yes, says Beatty. He reaches over and pats my hand. So we should just leave you alone, right?
People laugh. I even smile a little.
Well, that's all very nice, but not very helpful, says
Fulvia peevishly.
Unfortunately, her opportunities for being wonderful are rather limited here in 13, so unless you're suggesting we toss her into the middle of combat...
That's exactly what I'm suggesting, says
Haymitch.
Put her out in the field and just keep the cameras rolling.
But people think she's pregnant, Gale points out.
We'll spread the word that she lost the baby from the electrical shock in the arena, Plutarch replies. Very sad. Very unfortunate.
The idea of sending me into combat is controversial, but Haymitch has a pretty tight case. If I perform well only in real-life circumstances, then into them I should go.
Every time we coach her or give her lines, the best we can hope for is okay. It has to come from her. That's what people are responding to.
Even if we're careful, we can't guarantee her safety, says
Boggs.
She'll be a target for every...
I want to go, I break in. I'm no help to the rebels here.
And if you're killed? Asks
Coyne.
Make sure you get some footage. You can use that anyway,
I answer.
Fine, says Coyne, but let's take it one step at a time. Find the least dangerous situation that can evoke some spontaneity in you.
She walks around command, studying the illuminated district maps that show the ongoing troop positions in the war.
Take her into 8 this afternoon. There was heavy bombing this morning, but the raid seems to have run its course. I want her armed with a squad of bodyguards. Camera crew on the ground. Haymitch, you'll be airborne and in contact with her. Let's see what happens there. Does anyone have any other comments?
Wash her face,
says Dalton. Everyone turns to him.
She's still a girl, and you made her look 35.
Feels wrong, like something the Capitol would do.
As Coyne adjourns the meeting, Haymitch asks her if he can speak to me privately. The others leave, except for Gale, who lingers uncertainly by my side.
What are you worried about? Haymitch asks him. I'm the one who needs the bodyguard.
It's okay, I tell Gale, and he goes. Then there's just the hum of the instruments, the purr of the ventilation system. Haymitch takes the seat across from me.
We're going to have to work together again, so go ahead, just say it.
I think of the snarling, cruel exchange back on the hovercraft, the bitterness that followed, but all I say is, I can't believe you didn't rescue Peter.
I know,
he replies. There's a sense of incompleteness, and not because he hasn't apologized, but because we were a team. We had a deal to keep Peter safe. A drunken, unrealistic deal made in the dark of night, but a deal just the same. And in my heart of hearts, I know we both failed.
Now you say it, I tell him.
I can't believe you let him out of your sight that night,
says Haymitch. I nod. That's it. I play it over and over in my head.
what I could have done to keep him by my side without breaking the alliance, but nothing comes to me.
You didn't have a choice. And even if I could have made Plutarch stay and rescue him that night, the whole hovercraft would have gone down. We barely got out as it was.
I finally meet Haymitch's eyes. Seam eyes, gray and deep and ringed with the circles of sleepless nights.
He's not dead yet, Katniss.
We're still in the game. I try to say this with optimism, but my voice cracks.
Still in, and I'm still your mentor.
Haymitch points his marker at me.
When you're on the ground, remember, I'm airborne. I'll have the better view, so do what I tell you.
We'll see, I answer. I return to the remake room and watch the streaks of makeup disappear down the drain as I scrub my face clean. The person in the mirror looks ragged, with her uneven skin and tired eyes, but she looks like me. I rip the armband off, revealing the ugly scar from the tracker. There, that looks like me too. Since I'll be in a combat zone, Beatty helps me with armor Cinna designed. A helmet of some interwoven metal that fits close to my head. The material's supple, like fabric, and can be drawn back like a hood in case I don't want it up full time. A vest to reinforce the protection over my vital organs. A small white earpiece that attaches to my collar by a wire. Beatty secures a mask to my belt that I don't have to wear unless there's a gas attack.
If you see anyone dropping for reasons you can't explain, put it on immediately, he says.
Finally, he straps a sheath divided into three cylinders of arrows to my back.
Just remember, right side, fire, left side, explosive, center, regular. You shouldn't need them, but better safe than sorry.
Boggs shows up to escort me down to the airborne division. Just as the elevator arrives, Finnick appears in a state of agitation.
Katniss! They won't let me go. I told them I'm fine, but they won't even let me ride in the hovercraft.
I take in Finnick, his bare legs showing between his hospital gown and slippers, his tangle of hair, the half-knotted rope twisted around his fingers, the wild look in his eyes, and know any plea on my part will be useless. Even I don't think it's a good idea to bring him. So I smack my hand on my forehead and say,
"Oh, I forgot! It's this stupid concussion. I was supposed to tell you to report to Beatty in special weaponry. He's designed a new trident for you."
At the word trident, it's as if the old Finnick surfaces.
Really? What's it do?
I don't know, but if it's anything like my bow and arrows, you're going to love it, I say. You'll need to train with it, though.
Right, of course. I guess I better get down there, he says.
Finnick? I say. Maybe some pants? He looks down at his legs as if noticing his outfit for the first time. Then he whips off his hospital gown, leaving him in just his underwear.
Why? Do you find this?
He strikes a ridiculously provocative pose.
Distracting?
I can't help laughing because it's funny, and it's extra funny because it makes Boggs look so uncomfortable, and I'm happy. Because Finnick actually sounds like the guy I met at the Quarter Quell.
I'm only human, O'Dare.
I get in before the elevator doors close. Sorry, I say to Boggs.
Don't be. I thought you handled that well, he says. Better than me having to arrest him, anyway.
Yeah, I say. I sneak a sidelong glance at him. He's probably in his mid-40s, with close-cropped gray hair and blue eyes. Incredible posture. He's spoken out twice today, in ways that make me think he would rather be friends than enemies. Maybe I should give him a chance, but he just seems so in step with coin. There's a series of loud clicks. The elevator comes to a slight pause and then begins to move laterally to the left.
It goes sideways? I ask. Yes, there's a whole network of elevator paths under 13, he answers. This one lies just above the transport spoke to the 5th airlift platform. It's taking us to the hangar.
The hangar, the dungeons, special defense. Somewhere food is grown, power generated, air and water purified. 13 is even larger than I thought.
Can't take credit for much of it, says Boggs. We basically inherited the place. It's been all we can do to keep it running.
The clicks resume. We drop down again briefly, just a couple of levels, and the doors open on the hangar.
Oh!
I let out involuntarily at the sight of the fleet, row after row of different kinds of hovercraft.
Did you inherit these, too?
Some we manufactured, some were part of the Capital's Air Force. They've been updated, of course, says Boggs. I feel that twinge of hatred against 13 again.
So you had all this, and you left the rest of the districts defenseless against the Capital?
It's not that simple. He shoots back. We were in no position to launch a counterattack until recently. We could barely stay alive. After we'd overthrown and executed the Capital's people, only a handful of us even knew how to pilot. We could have nuked them with missiles, yes, but there's always the larger question. If we engage in that type of war with the Capital, would there be any human life left?
That sounds like what PETA said, and you all called him a traitor, I counter.
Because he called for a ceasefire, says Boggs. You'll notice neither side has launched nuclear weapons. We're working it out the old-fashioned way. Over here, Soldier Everdeen?
He indicates one of the smaller hovercraft. I mount the stairs and find it packed with the television crew and equipment. Everyone else is dressed in 13's dark gray military jumpsuits. Even Haymitch, although he seems unhappy about the snugness of his collar. Fulvia Cardew hustles over and makes a sound of frustration when she sees my clean face.
All that work down the drain. I'm not blaming you, Katniss. It's just that very few people are born with camera-ready faces.
Like him.
She snags Gale, who's in a conversation with Plutarch, and spins him toward us.
Isn't he handsome?
Gale does look striking in the uniform, I guess. But the question just embarrasses us both, given our history. I'm trying to think of a witty comeback when Boggs says brusquely,
Well, don't expect us to be too impressed. We just saw Finnick O'Dare in his underwear.
I decide to go ahead and like Boggs. There's a warning of the upcoming takeoff, and I strap myself into a seat next to Gale, facing off with Haymitch and Plutarch. We glide through a maze of tunnels that opens out onto a platform. Some sort of elevator device lifts the craft slowly up through the levels. All at once, we're outside in a large field surrounded by woods. Then we rise off the platform and become wrapped in clouds. Now that the flurry of activity leading up to this mission is over, I realize I have no idea what I'm facing on this trip to District 8. In fact, I know very little about the actual state of the war, or what it would take to win it, or what would happen if we did. Plutarch tries to lay it out in simple terms for me. First of all, every district is currently at war with the Capital except 2, which has always had a favored relationship with our enemies despite its participation in the Hunger Games. They get more food and better living conditions. After the Dark Days and the supposed destruction of 13, District 2 became the Capital's new center of defense, although it's publicly presented as the home of the nation's stone quarries, in the same way that 13 was known for graphite mining. District 2 not only manufactures weaponry, it trains and even supplies peacekeepers.
You mean some of the peacekeepers are born in 2? I ask.
I thought they all came from the Capital.
Plutarch nods.
That's what you're supposed to think. And some do come from the Capital, but its population could never sustain a force that size. Then there's the problem of recruiting Capital-raised citizens for a dull life of deprivation in the districts. A 20-year commitment to the peacekeepers, no marriage, no children allowed. Some buy into it for the honor of the thing, others take it on as an alternative to punishment. For instance, join the peacekeepers and your debts are forgiven.
Many people are swamped in debt in the Capital, but not all of them are fit for military duty.
So District 2 is where we turn for additional troops. It's a way for their people to escape poverty and a life in the quarries. They're raised with a warrior mindset. You've seen how eager their children are to volunteer to be tributes.
Cato and Clove, Brutus and Inabaria. I've seen their eagerness and their bloodlust, too. But all the other districts are on our side, I ask.
Yes, our goal is to take over the districts one by one, ending with District 2, thus cutting off the capital's supply chain. Then, once it's weakened, we invade the capital itself, says Plutarch. That will be a whole other type of challenge. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
If we win, who would be in charge of the government? Gale asks.
Everyone, Plutarch tells him. We're going to form a republic where the people of each district and the capital can elect their own representatives to be their voice in a centralized government. Don't look so suspicious. It's worked before.
In books, Haymitch mutters.
In history books, says Plutarch. And if our ancestors could do it, then we can too.
Frankly, our ancestors don't seem much to brag about. I mean, look at the state they left us in, with the wars and the broken planet. Clearly, they didn't care about what would happen to the people who came after them. But this republic idea sounds like an improvement over our current government.
And if we lose? I ask. If we lose?
Plutarch looks out at the clouds, and an ironic smile twists his lips.
Then I would expect next year's Hunger Games to be quite unforgettable. That reminds me.
He takes a vial from his vest, shakes a few deep violet pills into his hand, and holds them out to us.
We named them Nightlock in your honor, Katniss. The rebels can't afford for any of us to be captured now, but I promise it will be completely painless.
I take hold of a capsule, unsure of where to put it. Plutarch taps a spot on my shoulder at the front of my left sleeve. I examine it and find a tiny pocket that both secures and conceals the pill. Even if my hands were tied, I could lean my head forward and bite it free. Cinna, it seems, has thought of everything.
Chapter 7. The hovercraft makes a quick spiral descent onto a wide road on the outskirts of 8. Almost immediately, the door opens, the stairs slide into place, and we're spit out onto the asphalt. The moment the last person disembarks, the equipment retracts. Then the craft lifts off and vanishes. I'm left with a bodyguard made up of Gale, Boggs, and two other soldiers. The TV crew consists of a pair of burly Capitol cameramen with heavy mobile cameras encasing their bodies like insect shells. A woman director named Cressida, who has a shaved head tattooed with green vines, and her assistant, Misala, a slim young man with several sets of earrings. On careful observation, I see his tongue has been pierced too, and he wears a stud with a silver ball the size of a marble. Boggs hustles us off the road toward a row of warehouses as a second hovercraft comes in for a landing. This one brings crates of medical supplies and a crew of 6 medics. I can tell by their distinctive white outfits. We all follow Boggs down an alley that runs between 2 dull gray warehouses. Only the occasional access ladder to the roof interrupts the scarred metal walls. When we emerge onto the street, it's like we've entered another world. The wounded from this morning's bombing are being brought in. On homemade stretchers, in wheelbarrows, on carts slung across shoulders and clenched tight in arms, bleeding, limbless, unconscious, propelled by desperate people to a warehouse with a sloppily painted H above the doorway. It's a scene from my old kitchen where my mother treated the dying, multiplied by 10, by 50, by 100. I had expected bombed-out buildings and instead find myself confronted with broken human bodies.
this is where they plan on filming me? I turn to Boggs.
This won't work, I say. I won't be good here.
He must see the panic in my eyes, because he stops a moment and places his hands on my shoulders.
You will. Just let them see you. That will do more for them than any doctor in the world could.
A woman directing the incoming patients catches sight of us, does a sort of double take, and then strides over. Her dark brown eyes are puffy with fatigue, and she smells of metal and sweat. A bandage around her throat needed changing about 3 days ago. The strap of the automatic weapon slung across her back digs into her neck, and she shifts her shoulder to reposition it. With a jerk of her thumb, she orders the medics into the warehouse. They comply without question.
This is Commander Paler of 8, says Boggs. Commander, Soldier Katniss Everdeen.
She looks young to be a commander, early 30s, but there's an authoritative tone to her voice that makes you feel her appointment wasn't arbitrary. Beside her, in my spanking new outfit, scrubbed and shiny, I feel like a recently hatched chick, untested, and only just learning how to navigate the world.
Yeah, I know who she is, says Paler. You're alive, then. We weren't sure.
Am I wrong, or is there a note of accusation in her voice?
I'm still not sure myself, I answer.
Been in recovery. Boggs taps his head. Bad concussion.
He lowers his voice a moment.
Miscarriage. But she insisted on coming by to see you're wounded. Well, we've got plenty of those, says Paler. You think this is a good idea? Says Gale, frowning at the hospital. Assembling your wounded like this?
I don't. Any sort of contagious disease would spread through this place like wildfire.
I think it's slightly better than leaving them to die, says Paler. That's not what I meant, Gale tells her.
Well, currently that's my other option. But if you come up with a third and get coin to back it, I'm all ears.
Paler waves me toward the door.
Come on in, Mockingjay. And by all means, bring your friends.
I glance back at the freak show that is my crew, steel myself, and follow her into the hospital. Some sort of heavy industrial curtain hangs the length of the building, forming a sizable corridor. Corpses lie side by side, curtain brushing their heads, white cloths concealing their faces.
We've got a mass grave started a few blocks west of here, but I can't spare the manpower to move them yet, says Paler.
She finds a slit in the curtain and opens it wide. My fingers wrap around Gale's wrist.
Do not leave my side,
I say under my breath.
I'm right here, he answers quietly.
I step through the curtain and my senses are assaulted. My first impulse is to cover my nose to block out the stench of soiled linen, putrefying flesh, and vomit, all ripening in the heat of the warehouse. They've propped open skylights that crisscross the high metal roof, but any air that manages to get in can't make a dent in the fog below. The thin shafts of sunlight provide the only illumination, and as my eyes adjust, I can make out row upon row of wounded, in cots, on pallets, on the floor, because there are so many to claim the space. The drone of black flies, the moaning of people in pain, and the sobs of their attending loved ones have combined into a wrenching chorus. We have no real hospitals in the districts. We die at home, which at the moment seems a far desirable alternative to what lies in front of me. Then I remember that many of these people probably lost their homes in the bombings. Sweat begins to run down my back, fill my palms. I breathe through my mouth in an attempt to diminish the smell. Black spots swim across my field of vision, and I think there's a really good chance I could faint. But then I catch sight of Paler, who's watching me so closely, waiting to see what I am made of, and if any of them have been right to think they can count on me. So I let go of Gale, and force myself to move deeper into the warehouse. To walk into the narrow strip between two rows of beds.
Katniss,
a voice croaks out from my left, breaking apart from the general din.
Katniss!
A hand reaches for me out of the haze. I cling to it for support. Attached to the hand is a young woman with an injured leg. Blood has seeped through the heavy bandages, which are crawling with flies. Her face reflects her pain, but something else, too. Something that seems completely incongruous with her situation.
Is it really you?
Yeah, it's me, I get out. Joy. That's the expression on her face. At the sound of my voice, it brightens, erases the suffering momentarily.
You're alive! We didn't know. People said you were, but we didn't know,
she says excitedly. I got pretty banged up, but I got better, I say, just like you will.
I've got to tell my brother.
The woman struggles to sit up and calls to someone a few beds down.
Eddie! Eddie! She's here! It's Katniss Everdeen!
A boy, probably about 12 years old, turns to us. Bandages obscure half of his face. The side of his mouth, I can see, opens as if to utter an exclamation. I go to him, push his damp brown curls back from his forehead, murmur a greeting. He can't speak, but his one good eye fixes on me with such intensity, as if he's trying to memorize every detail of my face. I hear my name rippling through the hot air, spreading out into the hospital.
Katniss! Katniss Everdeen!
The sounds of pain and grief begin to recede, to be replaced by words of anticipation. From all sides, voices beckon me. I begin to move, clasping the hands extended to me, touching the sound parts of those unable to move their limbs, saying, "Hello, how are you? Good to meet you." Nothing of importance, no amazing words of inspiration, but it doesn't matter. Boggs is right. It's the sight of me, alive, that is the inspiration. Hungry fingers devour me, wanting to feel my flesh. As a stricken man clutches my face between his hands, I send a silent thank you to Dalton for suggesting I wash off the makeup. How ridiculous, how perverse I would feel presenting that painted capital mask to these people. The damage, the fatigue, the imperfections, that's how they recognize me, why I belong to them. Despite his controversial interview with Caesar, many ask about Peeta, assure me that they know he was speaking under duress. I do my best to sound positive about our future, but people are truly devastated when they learn I've lost the baby. I want to come clean and tell one weeping woman that it was all a hoax, a move in the game. But to present Peeta as a liar now would not help his image, or mine, or the cause. I begin to fully understand the lengths to which people have gone to protect me. What I mean to the rebels, my ongoing struggle against the capital, which has so often felt like a solitary journey, has not been undertaken alone. I have had thousands upon thousands of people from the districts at my side. I was their mockingjay long before I accepted the role. A new sensation begins to germinate inside me. But it takes until I am standing on a table, waving my final goodbyes to the hoarse chanting of my name to define it. Power. I have a kind of power I never knew I possessed. Snow knew it as soon as I held out those berries. Plutarch knew when he rescued me from the arena. And Coin knows now. So much so that she must publicly remind her people that I am not in control. When we're outside again, I lean against the warehouse, catching my breath, accepting the canteen of water from Boggs.
You did great, he says.
Well, I didn't faint or throw up or run out screaming. Mostly I just rode the wave of emotion rolling through the place.
We got some nice stuff in there, says Cressida.
I look at the insect cameramen, perspiration pouring from under their equipment. Masala scribbling notes. I had forgotten they were even filming me.
I didn't do much, really, I say. You have to give yourself some credit for what you've done in the past,
says Boggs. What I've done in the past? I think of the trail of destruction in my wake. My knees weaken, and I slide down to a sitting position. That's a mixed bag.
Well, you're not perfect by a long shot, but times being what they are, you'll have to do, says Boggs.
Gale squats down beside me, shaking his head.
I can't believe you let all those people touch you. I kept expecting you to make a break for the door.
Shut up, I say with a laugh.
Your mother's going to be very proud when she sees the footage, he says.
My mother won't even notice me. She'll be too appalled by the conditions in there. I turn to Boggs and ask, is it like this in every district?
Yes, most are under attack. We're trying to get in aid wherever we can, but it's not enough.
He stops a minute, distracted by something in his earpiece. I realize I haven't heard Hamish's voice once, and fiddle with mine, wondering if it's broken.
We're to get to the airship immediately, Boggs says,
lifting me to my feet with one hand.
There's a problem.
What kind of problem? Asks Gale.
Incoming bombers, says Boggs.
He reaches behind my neck and yanks Cinna's helmet up onto my head.
Let's move.
Unsure of what's going on, I take off running along the front of the warehouse, heading for the alley that leads to the airstrip. But I don't sense any immediate threat. The sky's an empty, cloudless blue. The street's clear except for the people hauling the wounded to the hospital. There's no enemy, no alarm. Then the sirens begin to wail. Within seconds, a low-flying V-shaped formation of Capitol hoverplanes appears above us, and the bombs begin to fall. I'm blown off my feet, into the front wall of the warehouse. There's a searing pain just above the back of my right knee. Something has struck my back as well, but it doesn't seem to have penetrated my vest. I try to get up, but Boggs pushes me back down, shielding my body with his own. The ground ripples under me as bomb after bomb drops from the planes and detonates. It's a horrifying sensation being pinned against the wall as the bombs rain down. What was that expression my father used for easy kills? Like shooting fish in a barrel. We are the fish, the street the barrel.
Katniss!
I'm startled by Haymitch's voice in my ear.
What?
Yes, what? I'm here, I answer.
Listen to me. We can't land during the bombing, but it's imperative you're not spotted, he says.
So they don't know I'm here? I assumed, as usual, it was my presence that brought on punishment.
Intelligence thinks no, that this raid was already scheduled, says Haymitch.
Now Plutarch's voice comes up, calm but forceful, the voice of a head game maker used to calling the shots under pressure.
There's a light blue warehouse three down from you. It has a bunker in the far north corner. Can you get there?
We'll do our best, says Boggs. Plutarch must be in everyone's ear because my bodyguards and crew are getting up. My eye instinctively searches for Gale and sees he's on his feet, apparently unharmed.
You've got maybe 45 seconds to the next wave, says Plutarch.
I give a grunt of pain as my right leg takes the weight of my body, but I keep moving. No time to examine the injury. Better not to look now anyway. Fortunately, I have on shoes that Cinna designed. They grip the asphalt on contact and spring free of it on release. I'd be hopeless in that ill-fitting pair that 13 assigned to me. Boggs has the lead, but no one else passes me. Instead, they match my pace, protecting my sides, my back. I force myself into a sprint as the seconds tick away. We pass the second gray warehouse and run along a dirt-brown building. Up ahead, I see a faded blue facade, home of the bunker. We have just reached another alley, need only to cross it to arrive at the door when the next wave of bombs begins. I instinctively dive into the alley and roll toward the blue wall. This time it's Gale, who throws himself over me to provide one more layer of protection from the bombing. It seems to go on longer this time, but we are farther away.
I shift onto my side and find myself looking directly into Gale's eyes. For an instant, the world recedes, and there is just his flushed face, his pulse visible at his temple, his lips slightly parted as he tries to catch his breath.
"You all right?"
he asks, his words nearly drowned out by an explosion.
"Yeah, I don't think they've seen me," I answer. "I mean, they're not following us."
"No, they've targeted something else," says Gale.
"I know, but there's nothing back there, but..."
The realization hits us at the same time.
"The hospital."
Instantly, Gale's up and shouting to the others.
"They're targeting the hospital."
"Not your problem," says Plutarch firmly. "Get to the bunker."
"But there's nothing there but the wounded,"
I say.
"Katniss?"
I hear the warning note in Haymitch's voice and know what's coming.
"Don't even think about..."
I yank the earpiece free and let it hang from its wire. With that distraction gone, I hear another sound, machine gun fire coming from the roof of the dirt-brown warehouse across the alley. Someone is returning fire. Before anyone can stop me, I make a dash for an access ladder and begin to scale it, climbing, one of the things I do best.
"Don't stop!"
I hear Gale say behind me. Then there's the sound of his boot on someone's face. If it belongs to Boggs, Gale's going to pay for it dearly later on. I make the roof and drag myself onto the tar. I stop long enough to pull Gale up beside me, and then we take off for the row of machine gun nests on the street side of the warehouse. Each looks to be manned by a few rebels. We skid into a nest with a pair of soldiers, hunching down behind the barrier.
"Boggs, know you're up here?"
To my left, I see Paler behind one of the guns, looking at us quizzically. I try to be evasive, without flat-out lying.
"He knows where we are, all right."
Paler laughs.
"I bet he does. You've been trained in these?"
She slaps the stock of her gun.
"I have in 13, says Gale, "but I'd rather use my own weapons."
"Yes, we've got our bows." I hold mine up, then realize how decorative it must seem. "It's more deadly than it looks."
"It would have to be," says Paler. "All right, we expect at least 3 more waves. They have to drop their sight shields before they release the bombs. That's our chance. Stay low."
I position myself to shoot from one knee.
"Better start with fire," says Gale.
I nod and pull an arrow from my right sheath. If we miss our targets, these arrows will land somewhere, probably the warehouses across the street. A fire can be put out, but the damage an explosive can do may be irreparable. Suddenly, they appear in the sky, 2 blocks down, maybe 100 yards above us, 7 small bombers in a V formation.
"Geese!"
I yell at Gale. He'll know exactly what I mean. During migration season, when we hunt fowl, we've developed a system of dividing the birds so we don't both target the same ones. I get the far side of the V, Gale takes the near, and we alternate shots at the front bird. There's no time for further discussion. I estimate the lead time on the hover planes and let my arrow fly. I catch the inside wing of one, causing it to burst into flames. Gale just misses the point plane. A fire blooms on an empty warehouse roof across from us. He swears under his breath. The hover plane I hit swerves out of formation, but still releases its bombs. It doesn't disappear, though. Neither does one other I assume was hit by gunfire. The damage must prevent the sight shield from reactivating.
"Good shot," says Gale.
"I wasn't even aiming for that one," I mutter. I'd set my sights on the plane in front of it. "They're much faster than we think."
"Positions!"
Paler shouts. The next wave of hover planes is appearing already.
"Fire's no good,"
Gale says. I nod, and we both load explosive-tipped arrows. Those warehouses across the way look deserted anyway. As the planes sweep silently in, I make another decision.
"I'm standing,"
I shout to Gale and rise to my feet. This is the position I get the best accuracy from. I lead earlier and score a direct hit on the point plane, blasting a hole in its belly. Gale blows the tail off a second,
It flips and crashes into the street, setting off a series of explosions as its cargo goes off. Without warning, a third V-formation unveils. This time, Gale squarely hits the point plane. I take the wing off the second bomber, causing it to spin into the one behind it. Together they collide into the roof on the warehouse across from the hospital. A fourth goes down from gunfire.
All right, that's it,
Paler says. Flames and heavy black smoke from the wreckage obscure our view.
Did they hit the hospital?
Must have, she says grimly.
As I hurry toward the ladders at the far end of the warehouse, the sight of Masala and one of the insects emerging from behind an air duct surprises me. I thought they'd still be hunkered down in the alley.
They're growing on me, says Gale.
I scramble down a ladder. When my feet hit the ground, I find a bodyguard, Cressida, and the other insect waiting. I expect resistance, but Cressida just waves me toward the hospital. She's yelling, I don't care, Plutarch. Just give me 5 more minutes. Not one to question a free pass, I take off into the street.
Oh, no,
I whisper as I catch sight of the hospital.
What used to be the hospital?
I move past the wounded, past the burning plane wrecks, fixated on the disaster ahead of me. People screaming, running about frantically, but unable to help. The bombs have collapsed the hospital roof and set the building on fire, effectively trapping the patients within. A group of rescuers has assembled, trying to clear a path to the inside. But I already know what they will find.
If the crushing debris and the flames didn't get them, the smoke did. Gale's at my shoulder. The fact that he does nothing only confirms my suspicions. Miners don't abandon an accident until it's hopeless. Come on, Katniss. Haymitch says they can get a hovercraft in for us now, he tells me.
But I can't seem to move. Why would they do that? Why would they target people who were already dying? I ask him.
Scare others off. Prevent the wounded from seeking help, says Gale. Those people you met, they were expendable. To Snow, anyway. If the capital wins, what will they do with a bunch of damaged slaves?
I remember all those years in the woods, listening to Gale rant against the capital. Me, not paying close attention, wondering why he even bothered to dissect its motives. Why thinking like our enemy would ever matter? Clearly, it could have mattered today. When Gale questioned the existence of the hospital, he was not thinking of disease, but this. Because he never underestimates the cruelty of those we face. I slowly turn my back to the hospital and find Cressida, flanked by the insects, standing a couple of yards in front of me, her manners unrattled, cool even.
Katniss, she says. President Snow just had them air the bombing live. Then he made an appearance to say that this was his way of sending a message to the rebels. What about you? Would you like to tell the rebels anything?
Yes, I whisper. The red blinking light on one of the cameras catches my eye. I know I'm being recorded.
Yes, I say more forcefully. Everyone is drawing away from me. Gale, Cressida, the insects, giving me the stage. But I stay focused on the red light. I want to tell the rebels that I am alive, that I'm right here in District 8, where the Capitol has just bombed a hospital full of unarmed men, women, and children. There will be no survivors.
The shock I've been feeling begins to give way to fury.
I want to tell people that if you think for 1 second the Capitol will treat us fairly if there's a ceasefire, you're deluding yourself, because you know who they are and what they do.
My hands go out automatically, as if to indicate the whole horror around me.
This is what they do, and we must fight back.
I'm moving in toward the camera now, carried forward by my rage.
President Snow says he's sending us a message. Well, I have one for him. You can torture us and bomb us and burn our districts to the ground. But do you see that?
One of the cameras follows as I point to the planes burning on the roof of the warehouse across from us.
The capital seal on the wing glows clearly through the flames. Fire is catching! I am shouting now, determined that he will not miss a word. And if we burn, you burn with us. My last words hang.